We have Kennette Benedict, who you've already all met in the previous session, and she introduced herself, so we know a little bit about her already. But first, we're going to invite Arnie Gunderson up to the microphone. Arnie is chief engineer for Fairwinds Associates. He is an advisor with 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience, a former nuclear industry senior vice president. Mr. Gunderson earned his degrees in nuclear engineering from RPI, holds a nuclear safety patent, and was a licensed reactor operator. During his time, Mr. Gunderson was employed by the nuclear industry. He managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants around the country. After becoming a nuclear whistleblower in 1990, he became an independent nuclear engineering and safety expert. We're so glad you came to our side, Arnie Gunderson.
Hi, thank you for having me. I really have to thank the organizers. The person I see is Dave Kraft, but I'm sure there's dozens of people. Thank you. I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds, and today I wanted to talk about, I was asked to talk about the five, about old and new reactors. And when I got into it, I said, you know, there's five things that haven't changed in 70 years. And so I want to talk about the five things that, in my mind, have not changed. Rather, we're talking about the Mark I reactors at Fukushima or the AP1000s down at Vogtle or now the small modular reactors. I think there's five things that haven't changed. And the five things are secrecy and then subsidies. And both of those are sort of political. And then three mechanical things, and that's waste heat, the decay heat, and they're separate things. I'll talk about them. And the last thing is the pile of waste that's now 70 years old. So first is secrecy. You know, this is a technology that was born secret, and for good reasons. Back in 1939 and 1940, actually. 72 years of secrecy and a 70-year pile of waste. The origins of this technology were created in secret, and I think that mentality has actually continued through these 70 years. We see it. Kendra and I are working on the San Onofre plant. And an example of this secrecy, even today, is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will go to Edison, and they will pass documents back and forth across the table. But if the NRC doesn't take that document home, they haven't taken possession of it, and therefore it doesn't ever get into the public document room. So that's an example of this mentality of secrecy that has wound its way even to today. Well, that was a big jump, but let's look at it a little bit finer. If you look at, you know, the origins of the Manhattan Project, then morphed into the Atomic Energy Commission, and of course we had the promote and regulate concepts, but more importantly, the Atomic Energy Commission was really focused an awful lot on bombs. One of my favorite books on the 50s is a book called The Day We Bombed Utah, and it talks about the test that went awry and dropped an enormous amount of radioactivity on St. George. But more importantly is the dialogue with that's captured in the Atomic Energy Commission discussions about what the public should know. So the roots of this secrecy go right back to the bomb origins of the project, and that in turn drives a related issue, which is the topic of the nuclear priesthood. Now, and that's not my term. That's been around for years. I've heard a couple people take credit for it, but one of the previous speakers spoke about it. There is a nuke speak. It's almost like, do we read the text in Latin so nobody understands it, or do we let the public understand what's going on up here? Well, the NRC's approach is to, is to read the sacred texts in Latin, and preferably in a private room. And they would very much like for the priesthood, the NRC, and the people that operate these reactors to be the only ones that understand the language. Now, I'm speaking to you as a defrocked priest. I started in nuclear in 1970, got a reactor operator's license on a small modular reactor, Paul. It was the ALCO reactor. If anybody can tell me what that stands for, I'll give you a free coffee mug. Stands for the American Locomotive Company. And it was a locomotive reactor, and it had 60 kilograms of 93% enriched uranium in it, which is five bombs worth of nuclear fuel in a locomotive engine. And now we're back to small modular reactors yet again. I worked my way up to become a senior vice president, and I really thought the system worked until it didn't. And when I became a whistleblower, I went to the NRC, and I expected that the NRC would exonerate me. Instead, the NRC took bribes from my employer and missed all of the things that I had discovered. And this is where Bob Alvarez comes into my story. I don't know where he is here. Hi, Bob. There he is. Bob was on John Glenn's staff when my information made it to Congress and had congressional hearings, where John Glenn basically said, yeah, everything Gunderson said was right, and oh, by the way, you were taking bribes. Despite that, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission never, ever came to my aid. So an example of when you cross that threshold, a very famous nuclear attorney said to me, when I crossed the threshold, I asked him for some help as a whistleblower, and he said, Arnie, in this business, you're either for us or against us, and you just crossed the line. So enough for the secrecy and the priesthood issues. That's number one. And I think it's people like me, it's people like Paul, and other people in the room here that try to break that veil of secrecy. And that's important, but very dangerous because it's very difficult to break. The second is subsidies, and this industry is heavily subsidized. The Union of Concerned Scientists has said that the cost from a nuclear reactor would be about 5 cents more per kilowatt than it is if we had really taken into account all the subsidies. It's called busbar cost. And the energy that comes out of the plant is about 5 cents. And it should be 10 cents. In other words, essentially double because of the subsidies. Now, I said that I wanted to talk about five dangerous things. And why is the subsidy dangerous? And it's because that was deferred money. That money could have been spent on something else. It could have been spent on solar. It could have been spent on wind or a smart grid. But instead, we elect it to put it into nuclear. The net effect is that we've got a non-competitive source of power when subsidies are included, and in fact, the old safe, clean, reliable mantra of the nuclear industry makes it appear that nuclear power is incredibly safe. Both of those, the secrecy and the subsidies, are really driven by Congress. We don't have a Democrats and Republicans when it comes to nuclear power. We really have Democrats and Republicans. There's really no difference here, and they are essentially, we have a pro-nuclear Congress, and until we effectively change that, the issues of secrecy and the issues of subsidy will be really, really difficult to handle. The other three, I can go to my slideshow now. Thank you. All right, this is Nuclear 101, and everything you need to know about nuclear power, but we're afraid to ask. There's two ways to generate electricity. One is chemically. You stick two different metals into an orange, and out comes electricity. And the second way is mechanically, by Faraday discovered that if you put a magnet through a wire loop and move it back and forth, you'll get electricity. And that was in 1700, and really we haven't changed that way of making power since then. Whether it's a generator on a bicycle, or a windmill, or a hydroelectric dam, we are basically turning a generator, and that's moving a magnet through an electric field. So we're dealing with a technology here that dates back at least 300 years. And essentially nothing has changed. It's been improved, but nothing has changed. Well, within that subset of spinning a generator, some people decide to spin those generators with steam. And you can spin them with coal, burn coal, and you create steam. You can spin them with oil, burn oil, you create steam, gas, and then nuclear. Now, we seem to be quoting Einstein today a little bit. I wonder how many of these Einstein quotes are really Einstein quotes, but he has some great ones. This one, I think, really, really speaks to the matter and gets to my point number three, that boiling water with nuclear power is one hell of a way to boil water. The reason is that nuclear fuel can't get too hot. A nuclear plant is much less efficient than a coal plant and much less efficient than a gas plant. So our most modern technology, our 70-year-old technology, is really only, it really has the technological disadvantages that we had with steam plants way back in the early 1800s. I think Paul mentioned 33% is the efficiency of a nuclear plant. A coal plant will be 40 or 42%. And what that means is per megawatt that comes out, about 40% more heat is dumped into the nearest river if you're going to compare nuclear to coal. And then if you're going to compare nuclear to gas, it's even more absurd. It's almost 2-to-1 on a modern high-efficiency combined cycle gas plant. So we've chosen a way of boiling water that is the least efficient way of boiling water because we can't let the nuclear fuel get too hot. If it gets too hot, we have a Fukushima on our hands. So by keeping the nuclear fuel cooler, we wind up creating an enormous amount of thermal waste. Now, what does that mean in the big scheme of things? Well, Indian Point runs 2 billion gallons of water through it every day. So that's alive, vibrant water that goes in. It gets heated up 40 plus degrees and comes out dead water. The other example is up in Vermont, and this is from the Connecticut Riverkeeper. He told me that before Vermont Yankee was built in the 80s, they did a shad population survey. And the shad, there's about 70,000 shad count it in the river heading upstream. Shad are, they go out to sea and they come back every 4 years. About 70,000 shad going upstream before the plant turned on. And now there's 16. Not 16,000, 16. So we've essentially decimated the shad population. Now, I've looked at it, and of course, for my Yankees, argument is we need nuclear power because it saves on global warming. Well, I did the calculations, and if you take, and yes, Vermont Yankee saves a little bit of CO2, and it's probably, if we take Vermont Yankee and decide to mothball it, the CO2 will raise the temperature of the Earth about a millionth of a degree. But in the process, we save the Connecticut River. And related to this, I'm sure you've all seen, the part of the plant that I'm talking about here is not inside the nuclear reactor, but this waste heat that heads back out. We've seen in the last 2 or 3 years, plants have to shut down because there's not enough cooling water in the river. And for instance, at Vermont Yankee was running at 80% power for most of the summer because with global warming, the river got so warm and the river flow got so low that there wasn't enough water to remove the decay heat. Now, Dave Lockbaum has said it best. He said, you know, people are portraying nuclear power as we need nuclear power to make the world safe for global warming. And the answer is that that's the opposite. We actually need to eliminate global warming to make the world safe for nuclear power. Okay, so number one was the secrecy. Number two was the subsidies. Number three was this issue of waste heat. The other two relate to what happened here in Chicago 70 years ago. A neutron hits a uranium atom, and it splits. Now, what excited scientists at the time was that right here, an enormous amount of energy was given off. Per atom, that chain reaction creates about a million times more power than burning an atom of coal. So it looked like free and abundant energy, too cheap to meter. Now, what they didn't take into account was that and that. And that's the decay daughter products that are left behind. You know, I went to RPI for 5 years, and we never talked about those two. It was always about the amount of heat that you could get out of the initial fissioning. And then also the mathematical difficulty here. And the beauty of the math, guys like Szilard and Fermi figured this out and tried it out on the atomic pile. When you put one neutron in, you get three neutrons out. And the goal is to get one of those to hit another uranium atom. And the math on that, I'll tell you, is very intriguing and fascinating. It took years of some brilliant minds to figure out. And that's what enthralled the scientists. And no one ever worried about this and this, the radioactive fission products. Well, if one neutron can split and create a lot of heat, then one of those three neutrons can then split and create a lot of heat, and so on. We become a chain reaction just like happened here 70 years ago. And what's left behind are all these little grapes, the radioactive fission products. They didn't worry about that in Chicago. And frankly, we did not talk about them in engineering school. We were they account for about 5% of the heat that comes out of a nuclear reactor. So everybody's excited about the pop. That's 95% of the heat, and nobody seemed to worry about the 5% of the heat that comes from these leftover radioactive daughter products. And again, it doesn't matter whether it was the pile here 70 years ago or Fukushima or the AP1000. That's a fact of nature. There's no way that those uranium atoms split into daughter products and don't leave waste behind. It's not a chemical problem. We can't transmute this. Those products are going to stay and are going to be with us for centuries in the case of cesium and quarter of a million years in the case of plutonium. Okay, so the advantages of nuclear power is that you get an enormous amount of power for very little mass. And that's the old E equals MC squared. C is 300,000. So when you square 300,000 times 300,000, it's a whole lot of zeros. So there's an enormous amount of energy that comes out of this process. That's what intrigued the scientists. But what they really didn't spend a lot of time thinking about is that these radioactive daughter products remain physically hot for 5 years, and Bob was talking about 100 years for some of these radioactive daughter products. And then they also didn't talk about the fact that some of these radioactive daughter products remain radioactive for centuries. Okay. This is example number one of radioactive fission products remaining hot after the chain reaction shut down. When the tsunami hit Fukushima, the control rods fell in. The chain reaction stopped. There's no doubt the chain reaction stopped. But then the diesels failed, and there was no way to cool the plant. So even though the chain reaction stopped, we had this. So turning a reactor off doesn't turn the heat off. And it can't. There's no magic formula to change this on the AP1000 or on the small modular reactor in Alaska. This is with us and will be with us forever. So problem number four is what to do with that decay heat. And the answer is, unless the electricity stays on, you're going to have a meltdown. Now, this is fascinating. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the chances of a meltdown are somewhere around 1 in 100,000 per reactor year to 1 in a million. So if you do the math on that, and I teach math at the community college every Monday in Vermont if you want to come by. You put 100,000 in the numerator and 400 nuclear plants in the denominator and do that math, and that's about once every 250 years. Now, if you put a million in the denominator and 400 to 400 nuclear plants, it's about once every 2,000 years. So if George Washington had built 400 nuclear plants, if you believe the policymakers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, if you believe the priesthood, we wouldn't have any nuclear accidents even through today. From Washington time to today, there should be none if you believe the probabilistic risk assessment. If you use their high-end number, 1 in a million, you could have built those 400 nuclear plants when the Parthenon was built, and you'd have no nuclear accidents. Well, we know there's been 5 meltdowns in the last 35 years. TMI, Chernobyl, and 3 at Fukushima. So you do that math, 35 divided by 5 is 1 in 7. So history tells us that there's a once in a decade chance of a meltdown. And the NRC is informing our policymakers in Congress that it's not going to happen over the next 200 years. Clearly, there's a disconnect with the numbers. So the second part of that, so that's these radioactive fission products have to be physically cooled for a couple years. But then after that, they remain radioactive for many, many years. We use the term 10 half-lives. So for instance, cesium is just one isotope I happen to choose because it's in the news a lot, but it could be strontium or any of these. Cesium's got a 30-year half-life. So if you had a million atoms of cesium, 30 years later, you'd have 500,000. 30 years after that, it doesn't go to nothing. It's half of the half. So you're at 250,000. 90 years still, 125,000 atoms. Until you get out about 300 years before you don't have to worry about the cesium anymore. Now that's why when we talk about Fukushima Daiichi or the Fukushima prefecture being contaminated, this is not a problem that's going to go away tomorrow. This is going to wash down and into watersheds and then biologically be brought back up through the roots of the plant and redeposited on the surface for 300 years. This is not a problem that goes away. The second half of this is what do you do with the waste? So I'm at number 5 and we'll be done shortly here. What do you do with the waste? And the waste is the cesium and the strontium, and perhaps we can imagine something that we could build that would keep that out of harm's way for 300 years. But more importantly is this thing called plutonium. Now, plutonium is not a fission product. It doesn't come from splitting uranium. Plutonium comes when a neutron doesn't hit uranium-235, it hits uranium-238. And then that decays to uranium, that creates uranium-239, which decays to neptunium and then quickly to plutonium. Within about 2 days, that neutron that hit the uranium-238 becomes plutonium-239. That's got a 24,000-year half-life, 24,000 and change half-life. And it's made in abundance. We talk about hundreds of pounds of this material per reactor per year, and we've got 400 of these reactors. Well, there's a movie I'm sure at least half the people in this room have seen it already, and if you haven't, I highly recommend it. It's called Into Eternity. And it discusses the problems of designing something that has to that has to secure a material for a quarter of a million years. Have to remember, the pyramids are only 5,000 years old, or less. So we're talking about they have to last 50 times longer than the pyramids. And we think, in our hubris, that we can do that. Okay. Now, it's a twofold problem. Well, and everybody seems worried about how do we warn future generations that there's something here and they really shouldn't dig here. You know, language changes so fast. 1,000 years from now, will we be speaking English? I doubt it. You know, so a sign that we put, you know, stay away, or some kind of a symbol that we put stay away, might very well be misconstrued by a future generation. And so there's a lot of academic debate about how to prevent people from inadvertently stumbling on this stuff 1,000 years out, or 10,000 years out, or 100,000 years out. So that's what Into Eternity focuses on. But there's another problem. And that's it. What if somebody wants it? I mean, here's the most dangerous material known to mankind that can make a huge bomb, and it's just down a couple hundred feet. What if a dictator comes in and wants to blow up the country next to it? Do you want to put a sign there? Maybe it would be better to let people forget that it's there, so that centuries out, it'll be more difficult to find. So it's a twofold problem. Do we protect the man from the plutonium, or do we protect the plutonium from the man? Either way, I submit it's bad news. Well, do we really need to do Into Eternity in the future? I submit to you no, and I think Arjun's presentation was eloquent on that. But as activists, let me leave you with this quote that it's mine. But you can use it. And it's it really encapsulates this issue, I think, really well, and I've gotten great responses when I've discussed it. And I said, we're seeing the cost of solar plummeting while nuclear is rising, Gunderson said. This is from a newspaper story about 2 weeks ago. But I also added that I had seen the rebuttal that the sun doesn't shine in the day and the night. But I said, but if you believe that man can build a repository to store nuclear waste for a quarter of a million years, surely those same people can find a way to store electricity overnight. Now, so the 5 points were the subsidies and the secrecy, and then the waste heat and the decay heat, and finally this issue of waste disposal. I Skyped my wife Maggie, who can't be here. She's recovering from a really severe fall and associated issues. But about a takeaway for you guys, and I have her takeaway, so let me get it. Okay, so this is from Maggie, and I hope she's watching. I think she might be live stream. Maggie's the founder of the company. Fairwind started in 2003, and I came on full time in 2008. And she, like me, came from the nuclear industry. She said, Fairwind's mission is to educate the public and decision makers about nuclear power. Take out the rhetoric. Take time to tell people the truth in simple, clear language. Refer them to sites with the facts. Don't use nuke speak. This is what Kendra was saying earlier. People will be shocked when you tell them the truth. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. Some people may not believe the facts about radiation release, as you've heard today. Starting at mining, I always hear, no one ever died from commercial nuclear power. And I think, our representative from South Dakota showed that that's clearly not true from the very get-out. Related to that is in talking to people, use today's technology. I was up on TweetDeck during the presentation, and I've only found 4 tweets this whole day from this group. We're not using today's technology to get to the young people. I know, I watch my kids. I can track what my kids tweet too. It's a great device, by the way, for parents. But and they'll be in a meeting and they're tweeting, you know, 10 times an hour. So we're not using the technology. And I think that's really where Fairwinds has been able to succeed a little bit, is that we've better used today's technology to get the message out to people who really need to hear it. Okay, thank you very much.